I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. Today, I'm conjuring up a treat for you as I bring you, ta-da, a history of magic. As a performer, I've always really admired the brilliant way stage magicians can capture an audience's attention with that how do they do it thing. And I wanted to find out more about the history of stage magic from Harry Houdini to David Copperfield. I recently read too that magicians have better mental health than most of us. So there really is a lot to admire about the great art of magic and those who perform it. And there's a fantastic and rather romantic history behind it too. So to help me pull this off, I've invited two accomplished magicians who are both members of the Magic Circle and historians of the great art of illusion to boot, Laura London and Paul Keeve.
In magic, there are some times when an apparent mistake is an advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. Mentalism is such a good example of that because, you know, it's just all about presentation. And that's the one thing that's hugely different between, say, myself doing magic as the performer. I'm fully in control of what I'm doing and what I'm saying. And if I make a deliberate mistake or a mistake happens, I can fix it.
Before we get to that, Melissa, my producer, is here for a chat. Hello.
Magic. I think everyone remembers the first time they saw magic and watching magic on stage or screen. What were your early memories of magic?
The girl who lived next door but one.
It was a girl.
She had a magician who came to her birthday party every year. Aww. And it blew me away. But I'll tell you more about that later on. I suppose the magician who I remember most vividly was Tommy Cooper. I think because I've always been a bit of a comedian. Yeah. To see somebody who can carry those two skills, three maybe, that he was a very good magician. He was a very good character actor. You know, that the character with the fez of Tommy Cooper that he performs. And he was a comic. Juggling those three things, well, he couldn't juggle, but you know what I mean. I always found brilliant.
What about Paul Daniels? Do you remember him? Because I have real vivid memories of Paul Daniels on Saturday telly.
I do. He was on every Saturday forever, yeah. Wasn't he? But I think I was a bit sniffy about Paul Daniels at the time. People took the mickey out of him a lot, didn't they?
He got quite a bad press. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think it is. And working with his wife too, who I think was very skilled in her own right, Debbie McGee. It was at the very end of the time when magicians had, in inverted commas, pretty girls alongside them, who were in effect actually operating an awful lot of the magic, but we didn't realise that at the time. It just seemed a bit dated. Looking back on it, I have an enormous amount of respect for him, and I feel a bit bad that I didn't give him more of a go in his own time.
Well, let's hear more about magic.
I have with me two fabulous masters of the art of illusion, Laura London and Paul Keeve. The reason that I got you two here today is really an event out of my childhood. The most exciting and important day of the year for me between about the ages of 6 and 10 was Susan Pears, the girl next door but one, on her birthday, they would have a magician. And I remember so vividly being crammed into this little lounge, about 20 of us, while this bloke would come in and just do his shtick for 45 minutes or so. And it was wonderful. It was amazing that these things could happen. And thinking about it now, I was thinking, why was it so amazing? It was because we all kind of live in a world of logic where things go up or they go down and everything is as it's supposed to be. And suddenly this bloke comes in, and in that room for three quarters of an hour, it was a different world where different crazy weird rules applied. And I think even now, like, you know, if you go to a wedding or a bar mitzvah or something and there's a magician coming in, you kind of know that it's, in inverted commas, just magic. But when that trick is done, those first few moments, you don't go, oh, yes, I know how you do that. We all still go, ah, like we're in a different world. And it's that different world and the way people have earned a living at it for the last 2,000 years that I wanted to talk about today, if that's fantastic. All right.
Absolutely.
Laura, I know there are some weird etchings on Egyptian tombs, which some people interpret as somebody doing magic, aren't there?
There certainly is. There's quite a famous one. It's of a man sort of doing what looks like a cup and ball effect, which of course is, we all know, is a very, very old effect, thousands of years old. But we don't actually know if that etching is real.
We know it exists, although I think, yeah. I believe it's at the bottom of the Aswan Dam now, because it was one of those that kind of got flooded.
Yeah.
But it looks like a man with three cups, and there's the cups and balls, which is probably most people have seen on the streets of Covent Garden, is definitely one of the oldest tricks in existence.
Remind me how it works.
There are three cups, and basically it's the fundamental thing is there's one ball that is put under one cup and it disappears from there, appears under another one. And normally at the end, all the cups are lifted up and there is something surprising, either oranges or even livestock, like one-day-old chicks and things I've seen in Cairo. But this is definitely one of the oldest things. So therefore, there was an engraving in the side of an Egyptian tomb that does exist, but there's some discussion about whether it's really a magician doing that trick or whether he's just like having his breakfast, I think.
You can say that about any etching in history, though, can't you? It might not be what we think it is. I'm prepared to go with the fact that that's our first piece of solid evidence. After that, things get a bit misty, don't they, for a very long time?
Well, you've got, of course, all the witches. There was a whole world of magic that existed that, well, I think were probably considered of the dark arts as opposed to magical entertainment, which might have put some people off, I suspect, actually performing it as an entertainment in those days, in that sort of period, just because they didn't want to be killed.
Yeah, they didn't want to be associated with the devil, even if they were just doing cup or ball. Some peasants in the countryside might go, ah, that is Beelzebub at work, chop her hands off.
But of course, there is The Discovery of Witchcraft, which is the first, I would say, one
That's
of the
That's a book,
first
isn't it? The Discovery of Witchcraft. What was in it, Paul?
Well, The Discovery of Witchcraft was written by a guy called Reginald Scott, who I believe made his fortune in hop production or hop process.
What type of year are we talking about?
It was published, the first edition was 1584.
Yeah.
And I think it was motivated by his concern that some nice sort of sleight of hand artists and good honest charlatans were being put to death as witches. And it was at this kind of witch hunt era. So the book was really looking at witchcraft, and he wasn't entirely sceptical. I mean, he did include, especially the third edition, has an entire section that if you want to sort of conjure up the spirit of your next door neighbour or something, it's got those instructions in it. But importantly, there was a very, very significant section in it, and it's the first written description of sleight of hand and magic illusions as well, not just conjuring.
What sort of ones did it describe?
Earlier on, there's a man called Brandon, and Brandon's effect was to get a spectator in a town square to stare at a pigeon, and that pigeon, after a couple of minutes, would fall dead from the rooftops.
And that's in this book.
And the method was that you had to feed this poor pigeon a chemical called Nux vomica, and this would give it a sort of delayed death reaction. Now, this isn't... I don't think you probably saw this at that kid's party, Tony.
Not that I remember, no.
But I think Laura Bacazzori is an expert sleight-of-hand artist. I think maybe there were other sleight-of-hand tricks, weren't they, in there as well, that even performed today?
Yeah, of course, yeah, there are. In fact, we've got a copy at the Magic Circle on display with some of those props, actually. I don't really know what that one with the wooden thing is that we have on display.
Well, there's a few... There was a few... They liked... One of the things that was really...
Knife through finger.
They were quite keen on chopping noses off. There's a nose thing, and there's a strange lock that goes on your lip or something. But importantly, I'm designed stage illusions. That's a kind of bigger scale magic as opposed to handheld magic. And there's a trick called the decollation of John the Baptist, which shows you how you can have somebody's, not actually chop their head off, but have the body and the head next to it on a platter. And it describes the sort of under-the-table view.
So how does it work?
Well, it is not really a decapitation. There are two performers, and one of them lies on the top and kind of ducks their head under the table, kind of flexible neck, I would say. And the other one is sat underneath the table with his head through a hole in the platter. And I think some very clever use of some kind of 16th century blancmange and jellies around the neck. But it's a really amazing illustration. And apparently that was done in Bartholomew Fair and places like that.
And that's in this book?
It's in the book.
And I think it's a kind of rubbish trick in a way, isn't it? There's two holes. One guy lies down in it and you see his body. Another guy sticks his head out the other hole and that's his head.
But you can imagine at that time, though, how extraordinary and how gruesome that would have looked, yeah. You know, especially with, you know, sort of the fake blood and all of that sort of thing. It would have been, you know, there was a lot of things that were quite gruesome in magic, I think, and I think it was quite enjoyable for people to watch.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because apart from the old Egyptian cup and ball, virtually everything that you've described up until the 1600s is like X-rated. It's all about decapitation and fingers coming off and noses.
That's not even the worst of it. There's one other one, very briefly. There's a chap whose trick was to be stabbed in the stomach and all this blood and guts would come out. And there's a horrible, awful account of this chap, which I can remember his name because I would give him, you know, his dues. Yeah. But there's a story of him getting a little tipsy and performing the trick in St. Paul's Churchyard. Oh. And unfortunately, he forgot to put his fake stomach plate in.
Ah!
So that was the last trick he ever did.
Show business. Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Stonehenge to Why Pies Were Invented, Why Do Our Dogs Love Us So Much, and the legend that is Miriam Margolyes. I'm sure you're going to find something you like, so why not take a lucky dip? Go on, it won't hurt you. In your everyday work, what kind of tricks is it that you do, Laura?
Well, so I specialise in close-up magic. What I do have is a one-woman show called Cheat, and it's about a card cheat from the 1920s. So that's sort of my love and my passion, and that's what I love to tour around and perform. And what it is it's card table artifice. So what that means is I sit behind a card table, I tell a story, and I use the playing cards to share some of my techniques that I've learned, in particular from a journal that belonged to a card cheat.
Tell me about that journal of the card cheat.
Well, her name is Geraldine Hartman. She's a card cheat of my imagination, but based upon lots of facts and lots of research in which that I've done. Through research, I actually have some really genuine and wonderful techniques that sort of you would use back in the 1920s, because don't forget, nowadays, you can't really cheat in a casino. It's all about electronics and you've got cameras. But back then, if a cheat was given a deck of cards, well, they could do all kinds of things and take your money. And despite what people think, there are actually many females doing that around that time. It wasn't just men. In fact, weirdly and interestingly, the men that gambled and cheated usually would go in the gambling dens that we're more accustomed to hearing about. Sometimes put their own shoes on the table in order to make the bet. Whereas women weren't like that. They were classy. They were playing in betting houses and dance clubs and they looked glamorous.
So what period are we talking about?
About 1915 to 1925 is when she was around. And it's also the basis of my study. But actually, female card cheats were way before that. In fact, you had Eleanor de Mont in the 1800s, who was this wonderful woman who grew a moustache and was known as Madame Moustache. And she was a very famous card cheat. So yeah, there was some really interesting and fascinating women. And that really inspired me to create that. But in my sort of everyday job, I do close-up magic at private events. But again, using sleight of hand, and I do love to do it with a deck of cards.
I love the image of Madame Moustache. You can imagine that if you were playing cards with a woman who had a big moustache, you wouldn't be looking at her hands, would you? Your eyes would keep flicking to the moustache.
Absolutely. Yes, she was from Belgium. Interesting character she was.
I have to say, Laura has got this shot of incredible red hair, mm-hmm. and she's dressed in black leather. You kind of go around like that all the time, or is this very much part of your persona?
This is pretty much me. I remember when I was... I've always had sort of red hair. In fact, I used to be a bit more of a punk, I would say. When I joined the Magic Circle at 18, I didn't have the best experience on day one because I think they took one look at me and went, yeah, if you're going to start coming to this establishment, you might want to start dressing more appropriately. Of course, in those days, this is 22 years ago now, they had a dress code, which they don't have anymore. And of course, I'm now not only their librarian, I'm very good friends with, you know, everyone in that club. And I adore the Magic Circle. I really do. Believe it or not, what you've just described is the toned down version of what I once was.
I remember when Laura turned up at the Magic Circle. It was the best thing that happened to the Magic Circle in about 50 years.
I bet. Because
came to make a splash.
What I was thinking when you were saying that is, in my mind's eye, the Magic Circle has always been a very straight place, middle-aged white men being rather austere about their art. Is that what you were confronted by?
You know what? The Magic Circle obviously is over 100 years old now, and like any sort of clubs, it has quite a checkered history up and down. Women were only allowed in, 30 years ago or so, somewhere around then. And as a consequence, of course, yes, of course, it was just full of men. I would say that. But I don't think I was confronted by a group
hostility?
Of people that were hostile. No, in fact, quite the opposite. When I joined, members such as Ali Bongo were there, and he was incredibly kind to me.
Yeah, I mean, Ali Bongo...
he was on TV.
His real name is William Wallace. He's a direct descendant of William Wallace.
Of the Scottish
yes.
revolutionary.
Can you believe it?
I knew his name was William Wallace, but I didn't actually know that there was a relation.
That's absolutely apparently a direct descendant.
But it was people like Ali Bongo and all these older gentlemen that once they'd sort of gotten over the initial shock of how I looked, when actually she's been doing this since she was a very little girl and have helped me.
I know it ought to be going back to the history, but I just want to poke around in your history. You just said... you were doing it as a very little girl. When did you start? Why did you start?
So when I was 5 years old, I was sort of bouncing off the walls. Mum didn't really know what was going on. And I was diagnosed very early on with a condition called ADHD, which is very commonly known now. That's attention deficit hypoactivity disorder. The doctor told my mum that I wasn't going to do well in school. I certainly wasn't going to hold down what they called a proper job. I mean, literally, we've got it on paper, proper job, they said. But if she's into anything creative, it should be encouraged. So she tried me with a few musical instruments and such. But when I was 8 years old, I went to a party and I saw a magician. He did this wonderful trick called the Run Rabbit Run. It's this sort of wooden contraption, and you get these sort of wooden rabbits, and it would appear and disappear, this little rabbit, through a sort of gate, what looked like a painted gate and doors. And all the kids, a bit like a Punch and Judy show, would go, you know, it's over there. And the magician would pretend like, oh, well, I haven't seen it. And it would vanish from one door and appear in the other. And it wasn't the trick itself that made me fall in love with magic, or the magician for that matter, although he was very good. It was just the way all the kids felt. And when my mum picked me up that day, I said, Mum, I want to do that. So after that, every Christmas, every birthday, I was given a small budget. I spent it in the magic shop. We have a family here in the UK called the Davenports. And Davenports are, I would argue, one of the most famous sort of magic families, dynasties that we have here. And they used to have a shop in Charing Cross Station. And I used to go there. I'm sure Paul went there, as we all went there. It was hidden under the station in Charing Cross. And it was just this magical place. There was a woman behind the counter called Betty Davenport. And again, when I was a kid, I didn't realise there weren't many women in magic, because my first introduction was to a woman behind a counter at a magic shop.
Paul, let's go back to the history. We've talked about what was happening in the late 1500s, where there was a guy writing a book saying, actually, there are all these tricksters out there, and they're not agents of the devil, they're just like a little bit of showbiz, which seems to imply, doesn't it, that there was a lot of this stuff going on that we don't know about. But then fairly soon after that, magic begins to become much more acceptable, doesn't it, when people start thinking that not every piece of sleight of hand is from the devil.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting era. And, you know, apparently, you know, there was a lot of discussion that this book was burned when James I came into session. You know, I think it was like, what was it?
1603.
Either way, this book was extremely popular. And there was, again, a lot of academics that say that they're pretty certain that Shakespeare read it, and it really influenced his view on the witches in Macbeth and stuff like that. So I think there was a move towards putting supernatural into plays as well, which obviously I'm very interested in. And I've worked on a couple of productions of The Tempest, because I do sort of behind-the-scenes stuff. And I remember one time Trevor Nunn was directing The Tempest, and he said, I really want to make the feast disappear in The Tempest. And, you know, I'd worked with him quite a few times. And I said, what makes you particularly want to do that? You know, why do you think that's accurate? Or why is that right? He said, in the text, the first folio, Shakespeare text, it says, it doesn't say the feast disappears. It says, by a quaint device, the feast vanishes.
Really?
Yeah. And the quaint device implies that there was mechanisms and equipment that made this happen. So, and it was a great out for me, because if it didn't work properly, I said, Trevor, you didn't say it had to be good, you just said it'd be quaint. So I think there's an interesting parallel which isn't talked about, which is how tricks and effects were used in theatrical plays. And at the same time, these sleight of hand deceptions, which in some ways are harder to pull off because they're right in front of people's noses, were very popular. It's often said that, I love this, that magic is the world's second oldest profession. Because I think people, as you describe that, what magicians call the experience of wonder, the experience of amazement, the reminder that there are impossible things. You know, we don't think about all the impossibilities of everyday life. It's a bit of a cliche to say it, even the fact we're on this big globe that's spinning round and travelling through space at X number of miles per second. And suddenly a magician can come along with a thimble and a bit of silk and blow your mind. Mm. And yet all these things that are going on are so extraordinary. So yeah, I think it was always there. And then you had Scott, which I think really records that this was going on the street. But I think there was Reginald Scott, who wrote The Discovery of Witchcraft.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I think him writing that, and he had to have the money to put that book together, implies that this was around. Mm. I mean, we haven't really got, you know, it's another whole subject. But of course, there's this overlap of like, where does religion start and where does magicians start? And of course, the conflict of the conjuring art and the church, for example, which is a huge subject. And that was, of course, you know, James I didn't like the idea of magic having any kind of power. Mm. But I think what you had was a rise in the street magicians. There was a brilliant man called Isaac Fawkes, who around the end of the 1600s, beginning of the 1700s, was an extremely publicised magician. Now, there's an interesting thing, because of course you had the beginnings of newspapers, and magicians were very quick to, they were the first, not the first, but they knew this was a good idea. If they were coming into town, thankfully for magic historians, they started to advertise, this magician would be in town, they are going to do these wonders. I mean, you can't actually believe the stuff they're saying. But this chap, Isaac Fawkes, used to perform at, I think he was a Londoner, And he did this extraordinary effect with a bag. It was like what we call now the egg bag, which is still performed, where an egg disappears in a bag. But he produced like chickens and 100 gold coins. And he apparently threw cards in the air that then changed into birds. And he became legendary. Now, how did you get to see, you know, Isaac Fawkes? You know, you couldn't switch on YouTube. So you heard this kind of, I think there was like this, well, there's this wonder worker. And he'd advertise and he would be written about a little bit. And Bartholomew Fair just sounds like an insane place.
So, it sounds a bit Monty Python now, doesn't he? There's this man, he has a bag, he puts an egg in it. And when you look in the bag, it disappears.
But you do have this move towards named performers. And there was a chap called Pinetti that was in it, who was in Italy. And they start to be recorded because of newspapers and because of advertising and copy, I suppose. And that there's that whole era. And then I suppose we move into the optical magic stuff, which was the thing that was starting to come in at the beginning of the 19th century.
Is this what they call the golden age of magic?
Well, this is actually kind of a century earlier than that.
Oh, so when's the golden age?
The golden age is really from around 1880 onwards. It's like the era of the variety theatres in the UK or vaudeville in America. That was really a jump from that sort of, a big jump from the street performers, and then you had these kind of optical magic shows, which were called phantasmagoria.
Yes, I sort of interrupted you there, because you were about to tell me about these optical shows in the early 19th century. What sort of thing did they do?
Well, I mean, I'm particularly interested, I'm very interested in the connection between the magician and the cinema, which they've always had a real connection, like symbiotic thing, because magicians obviously were always interested in anything that looked amazing and wonderful. And of course, the early use of magic lanterns would have seemed wonderful. They would have seemed otherworldly to people. So there was a chap called Robertson who apparently would, this is like the beginning of, you know, like Punch Drunk, they do, and they do the, what do you call it, immersive theatre. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't do just a magic show. They would gather people at midnight by a church and lead them into a dark crypt, a dark and damp crypt. And apparently they'd actually be burning some kind of slightly hallucinogenic drugs in their incense burners. And people would sit on pews. And there would smoke would rise, and then they would see these extraordinary images of like skulls and skeletons and witches and these coloured images in the smoke that would dissolve with the smoke.
Which were magic lantern projections.
And of course they'd figured out that if you slid the magic lantern away from the smoke, the image would get bigger. And there's this famous image which had a big skeleton. It said, "The fate that awaits us all." And apparently people would like drop to their knees sobbing and screaming. That was a magic. That's what I'd like to see. And then there was this link to the later optical effect, which all kind of tied into the beginning of Victorian magic and spiritualism, which was, I guess, the next step.
This is very interesting for me, because I'd always assumed that until fairly recently, magic was some bloke, and usually a bloke, who would stand up on a stage and make something disappear, and then it comes back to life again. But what it seems to me that you've both been saying is that always magic has been immersive, and that the shows that you see on in the West End now, where magic tricks take place, which I have always thought were like really modern and clever and arty, actually it's part of a very long tradition.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, also in this crossover that Paul was just speaking about, of spiritualism and magic, you had girls like the Fox sisters. I mean, they were going out as mediums, but they were little girls. I mean, one could assume they were doing magic tricks by the sound of what they were doing. Who knows? But Annie Eva Faye, she very famously did a spirit cabinet. So she was doing this sort of immersive spiritual magic show. You know,
when was this?
So she was doing that around the 1880s. And then sort of continued, actually she continued sort of as a medium magician for quite some time. She had quite a long career and it was incredibly successful at mixing these two genres together. And I mean, magic really is, as the genres of magic, I would say, are as vast and as different as the different genres in music. You know, there's so many different styles and different principles and different ways in which you can perform. She ended up doing more mind reading in the end, when she sort of got a bit debunked by several people and then sort of took on this sort of mind reading type performance. And again, she became very popular once more.
The other thing that strikes me about what you're both saying is how many of these magicians created a character. And it was the character who was doing it. It started with you saying about Ali Bongo and Mrs. Moustache and all that business. But this does seem to have been a recurrent theme among magicians.
Oh, yeah, I would say so. And then magic sort of, as we start to get into that golden age of magic, just became more opulent and grander and bigger. And the stages became, I mean, Serve Leroy, which I know is one of Paul's people that you really admire. He was this incredible magician. But there's this wonderful description of him just producing all of these silks that then turned into flags. And then those flags were then wrapped around sort of in these circular motions and produced hundreds of pigeons and geese and ducks.
That's proper magic.
So that's the, yeah. So, I mean, it definitely went, there was a definite move from that sort of darker spiritualism type magic.
Tell me more about this guy, Paul.
Well, Leroy, Survey Leroy, we are actually confessed as Leroy geeks.
Leroy and Talma.
Leroy and Talma.
And Talma, his
partner. So it's really interesting because you had a rise in the, as you said, these kind of personality magicians in a way, in an era when these theatres are being built everywhere. You know, these variety theatres. Serve Leroy was clearly a really, really accomplished sleight of hand artist. And he started off in what were called the dime cinemas in New York and met Houdini actually on that circuit. Harry Houdini, probably the most famous name connected to this stuff. So they started very lowly, kind of like in these performing lots of shows a day in these little cinemas. And then Leroy performed also in London and he met this incredible lady called Mary Ann Ford, which Laura will tell you a bit more about. But basically, Leroy became one of the most important inventors of magic principles. Now, this is an interesting thing. Principle doesn't mean, I don't mean moral principles. I mean, I mean actual ways. For example, you would say mirrors that came in strangely through science in magic. That's a principle because you can show a cabinet empty. There was a trick called the Proteus cabinet, which was really the disappearing box, if you like, the disappearing cabinet. That's where it started. And what it was a principle where you use mirrors in a very clever arrangement and it made the cabinet look empty. And then you close the cabinet and then you'd open it and someone would be in it. Now, that is a mirror principle. Mm-hmm. Now, Leroy didn't invent that, but he used it for the first use of like what I would say is transpositions in magic. Transposition might be, Tony, if you went over there behind the kind of technical booth and you dipped down and then you suddenly reappeared behind the TV screen that's behind us, you would have jumped in space. And that's a transposition.
I'm just going to do it. I'm going now. I've disappeared.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Hang on.
I'm over here.
Wow.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for that demonstration. Now, can you do it again?
No, I'm afraid my whole psyche has been burned by the effort that it took.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting you describe that, because the first person to do that, as far as we know, was Mr. Leroy. So the mirror principle he didn't invent, but he used it. But he did invent things that went into the DNA of magic, I would say, like the DNA, things that are still performed. He performed a trick called a wonderful levitation illusion that he called the Azra, A-S-R-A-H. And this was Talma, his partner, would lie on a table and she'd be covered with a beautiful silk cloth and she would float up underneath this silk cloth. And he pulled the cloth away and she vanished in the air. And I think it's the first time that somebody disappeared into thin air. And the difference between vanishing in the air and vanishing on the ground is you definitely knew she didn't go through a trapdoor.
Of course.
And so yeah. That is now this illusion that he first tested out in New York to a small audience apparently got such a bad response he didn't do it for another 5 years. And he tried it in Johannesburg in 1905, I think. And he was so nervous that he had Bosco, who was his comedy. There's Leroy, Talma and Bosco was the show, Comedians de Mephisto was what it was called. He had Bosco, who was this rather large gentleman who was the comedy kind of buffoon character. He had him in the wings, ready to run on with a tray of plates and fall over in case it was a big flop. And he performed it. And if I said to you that every single illusionist in the world probably has performed that illusion, is still performing it today, 118 years later, it's astonishing, you know, that he invented these things. But he invented many, many things.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Thelma,
you're the champion of her as distinct from him. What is it about her that you are so attracted to?
Well, so she's really, she started working at the London Aquarium, which was this incredible place right in the heart of London, which was a beautiful glass building. They had loads of performers there, all kinds of performers, from jugglers, mind readers and magicians and such. A terrible aquarium.
It was a failed aquarium,
but very good for entertainment.
All the fish died.
Yeah, all the fish died, so it was awful. But this was a place where you would go to seek out fantastic entertainment of the obscure and strange and wonderful. And she worked there, and we believe that this is where she met Leroy. And so she starts working as his assistant in sort of 1890, starts work, but she just gets the bug. She falls in love with magic. Survey Leroy was an excellent sleight of hand performer. He used to do manipulation. Manipulation is where you can produce coins and cards and such. And what she would do, she sort of took an act, or certainly took a lot of inspiration from a man called T. Nelson Downs, who had just written a book called Modern Coin Manipulation. And he was known for doing a miser's dream. And what this is a coin effect where you show your hands empty and you just produce a coin from thin air. And you could put it in a hat, I believe is how he did it. More modern magicians started putting it in champagne buckets. And the idea is you produce hundreds of coins from thin air. And it would just, you know, in her case, she'd go into the audience and she'd take it from people's beards and things like that. And she became so famous for this particular act that she had that they started calling her Thelma, the Queen of Coins.
Mm-hmm. Didn't she have a beautiful way of showing the coins to like the back of the audience with that device she had?
Yes, so that's, well, and again, that's one thing that's still often used today. It's called a coin ladder. And when you produce a coin, you can drop it in and it makes not only a beautiful sound, but it also has a shine to it with mirrors. And so it would just shine and you could see these coins falling in. And she'd not only just produce one at a time, sometimes she'd produce loads of them all
so,
at once.
So what are you saying? That she would put them on the top of the ladder and it would spin
and it would
down
twinkle down and it would go clink, 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 and it would just make this absolutely beautiful sound. And the more coins that went in it, the louder the sound was and the more echo it was in the theatre. And it was also a beautiful thing. It's how I do her act. I've had one made, but actually people are still using it today. There's so many, again, back in those days, so many wonderful illusions and pieces of magic that are still performed by great people because the magic is good. So yes, things have become very innovative and we've taken some of these effects and principles and modernized them. But actually, ultimately, some of the best were the ones that were created sort of back then.
So we're in the great golden age of magic now, round about the beginning of the 20th century. Let's have a breather from the chronology for a moment again and talk about your life. Honestly, reading Paul's CV, it is just great. You've shamelessly dropped the name of Trevor Nunn. You've worked at the Royal Shakespeare Company, at the National. You've done loads of West End shows. You've done loads of shows in New York. You do sound more like, you know, you're Cameron Mackintosh's right-hand man than my magician back in the 1950s in that little sitting room. But I suppose the principles are the same.
Well, I suppose what I do is I love storytelling magic. So I started out as an act many years ago. I used to do the variety nights at the Theatre Royal Stratford East, run by Kate Williams, who's a wonderful wonderful friend and actress. And Kate, when there was an incredible
director, writer called Ken Hill. Ken, in 1991, decided to do The Invisible Man on stage. And they needed somebody to do the effects. And I'd just come out of doing this double act that I was in a double act called the Zodiac Brothers. And we actually dressed up as Japanese ninjas and appeared on Japanese TV doing that. That's a whole other story. So I'd just been having that life. And basically, I was asked to do this world's first ever stage production of The Invisible Man. And it had over 40 effects in it. And I was exhausted. And, you know, Ken was a very tricky man to work with. Brilliant, but very, very hard to please. I think the only compliment I got was on about the third preview, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he goes, "You're working hard, mate." That was it. And Brian Murphy used to say he's very stinting when it came to praise, but he got great results. A lot of people came from the Joan Littlewood Theatre Workshop origins, who was an amazing theatre maker. And so I learned theatre, really. I learned how to put magic into theatre by being thrown in completely at the deep end. And thankfully, Invisible Man was a big hit. It came into the West End. This is 32 years ago now. And my second gig was immediately at the main house at the Royal Shakespeare Company doing Jekyll and Hyde with David Edgar and Simon Russell Beale and Roger Allen changing from Jekyll to Hyde.
Goodness me. Was that just because you'd done the one show?
The Royal
Shakespeare Company, they saw you and said, well, let's take this young lad.
You know how small the theatre world is. And I think that Roger Allen knew somebody in the cast. And I had no idea this was even going to happen. You know, I just thought it's a little show at Stratford East. I hadn't realised how important the theatre was. And really, I think it appealed to me because I think I wasn't so addicted to the performing side of it, and I certainly didn't want to get stuck on cruise ships. You know, that was a thing I felt. And then I found there's this whole incredible way of actually often creating these big scale illusions and things that you could never have the budget to do, or not only the budget, but the technical support that you can in a musical. So I guess I got to do my sort of dream of creating illusions and effects, some of them based on old things, some of them innovative, really kind of at someone else's budget, with some of the world's greatest lighting designers and set designers, and then having great actors to perform these effects, you know, and meaningfully in a story.
So where have you been? What's excited you? What are the most glamorous ones you've done?
Well, I don't know. Glamorous. I've just actually come back. Brighton's glamorous, isn't it? I've just been doing this Enfield haunting with Catherine Tate. I've done a couple of things.
That was on the telly, wasn't it?
Yes. One of my favourite things was actually kind of co-devising a sketch with Catherine Tate for her live show with Laura. And I was bothered, yeah. So very, very varied things. I mean, I'm the only magician to have actually appeared in Harry Potter or do any of the technical stuff on there, in the films. And I ended up teaching Daniel Radcliffe.
What did you do in the film?
I sit in the Three Broomsticks pub holding a candle, reading a newspaper, and the candle multiplies in my fingers. But I also did things like the Marauder's Map folding up at the end. Yeah, so that was incredible. I've done some work on Wonka. Most of last year, in terms of glamour and craziness, I worked on this gigantic show in Las Vegas called Awakening. And I don't know if you caught any of the Formula One stuff, but there was a big auction at Sotheby's and that was on our set. So they were using the Awakening set. So people were saying, hang on, James Corden just came in your glass appearing cabinet from... This is such a gigantic venue. It's got a 100-foot high dome. It's the glass stage is 60-foot diameter. It's got seats all the way around, which for magic is a kind of impossibility to do magic in the round. It's a cast of 55. It was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I was working on it for 3 years, and we opened about a year ago at the Wynn Hotel. And it's still on now. And when I came back, people said, how did it go? And I said, well, I got paid. I didn't have a nervous breakdown. I wasn't buried in the desert. And they're still talking to me. And that, to me, was a success. And it's got some cool magic in it.
Hi, I'm taking time out of this excellent chat to tell you how passionate I am about making these history shows for you, and I think it's pretty obvious from my voice most of the time. So if you are enjoying the series, please do leave us a rating or review, and most importantly, please, 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 please follow the series so you know when a new episode's dropped. This also helps to boost our place in the podcast charts. It is, as it were, some kind of, I'm searching for the words, cunning plan. And it ultimately means that we can make more and better episodes for you in the future. Thank you. Now, where were we? Do you get really scared when you're doing one of these big shows and it's the first time this particular trick has happened in this environment and it's the first night and the lights go up?
Yeah, I mean, it can be terrifying. There was briefly tell you the end of this show, which is, I believe, the largest illusion ever staged in Las Vegas, which is that a disc, the disc that you've seen rise up and down in the set, lifts up, so you can see underneath it. You see 8 foot gap underneath it, and then a scrim, or sort of like a voile circular curtain, descends, but you can see underneath and you can see above this curtain, and a girl ascends within it, and suddenly a 40 foot tall by 40 foot wide phoenix appears on this disc. Now, I'm letting you into a secret now, but it's not a real phoenix.
Oh,
it's not actually a real phoenix. So this phoenix was actually made by an incredible man called Michael Curry, who was famous for doing the puppets and stuff for the Lion King. This phoenix alone cost $1.3 million, right? And because of what it had to do, if it malfunctioned, there was a danger that it would literally destroy itself, that it would literally rip itself apart. So, and we had, if to say that we had problems, not just, it wasn't anything to do with Michael, it was just the combination of how it had to get there, the speed it had to move, the fact it was a magic illusion, the fact that it looked like nothing had happened. So there were all kinds of things that could throw this off. And there was safety issues, and like there was, you wouldn't believe what was going on under and behind the stage, all these things. And we had more than one occasion. It was like the ultimate, Tommy Cooper moment. With literally 44 people standing in a circle in beautiful costumes, music composed by Brian Tyler, who does Thor, this big dramatic thing coming out through this vast sound system, a huge disc lifting up, the end of the show, and at the end, the curtain flying away, and there being absolutely nothing there. Nothing. And that happened, I think, on two occasions. And another time, the lighting and the technical got out of sequence, so it was a complete show and tell. It's just the first time my mother saw it. She said, what was going on there? So when we came to the opening night, moments like that, you just kind of have to hold your breath and hope that everything comes together.
Is there going to be nothing?
Because
there?
You're there, probably the opposite, say, with Laura, when you, I know that with sleight of hand, you could still have things that can go wrong. You know, you can suddenly feel a bit, your hands could be clammy, or you.
Or you've got outs, I guess.
You've got outs.
Close up magic, you can go, oh, and nobody knows it messed up. Yeah. And so,
this is an opposite.
Hang on. What do you mean by out? So you're halfway through a trick.
And... So if I'm in the middle of performing a routine or a particular effect and it doesn't quite go my way, Well, they don't actually know what I'm doing in the first place. Therefore, I'm in a position using sleight of hand and my knowledge and the fact that I've done this probably hundreds or thousands of times, I can just go into something else. So, for example, you've signed a card, I've lost it in the deck, and it hasn't actually appeared where it's supposed to. But that's okay, because I'll find it and I'll produce it somewhere else. So there are situations that we can do as close-up magicians that I think is very, very difficult to do. One, certainly the effect in an illusion isn't even in your control, so you're not even the illusionist. You are watching your illusion being done by somebody else. But actually, I would say that it's also harder for the illusionist himself. So the people that do go out and do these cruise ships and things like that, again, if an illusion doesn't quite go your way, I don't think there's that many outs. But certainly there is with sleight of hand, just because we have this ability to use our hands to change things and make it go a slightly different way.
I think it's probably also to do with the theatre of it, isn't it? Mm. It's probably harder when you're doing your one-woman show. It's probably harder to do the outs because you're in a kind of a story.
Actually, no. Yeah. So I've built a show around the fact that it looks like things are going wrong all the time.
Right, right.
So actually, because I
well, that's cheat. That's a real cheat.
That's a cheat. That's why the show's called Cheat.
That's Tommy Cooper, isn't
so,
it?
So, I mean, for example, I just recently, part of the ending of the show is I take a deck of cards, I shuffle it all up and I put it all in order. And I've done it, and I can see I've done it, but the spades don't quite come out in order. But because it's all supposed to be a little bit messy, and as I'm shuffling, it looks like, gosh, there's no way she can keep this particular pack in an order anyway, because it looks If you're a card cheat, a genuine card cheat, the one thing you don't do is look like you're very good at cards because you'll get caught. So you try and do things slightly sloppier than maybe you might have done. But in this instance, I didn't have it. But what I did is I picked up all the spades, talked, told them more story, put them in an order I wanted because the audience don't know what I'm doing. And then I put them in order again because it's... I can do that.
Yeah. But the only thing as well, it's also, it's an interesting, I was thinking about some of that thing about the spiritualists. For example, Uri Geller. I saw Uri Geller doing a live stage show and his last effect was meant to be making a seed grow and nothing happened. And of course, the fact nothing happened was extremely strong. And it's a bit like, I suppose, with the card cheat stuff, because some of the sleight of hand is concealed sleight of hand, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So you're telling one story, but actually another thing is going on. So there are some things whereby the failure is incredibly important.
So can you remember how Uri Geller got out of it?
Oh, well, he didn't. At the end, he didn't get out of it. It just didn't happen. So he didn't have to, because he said, now I'm going to... He'd done a whole show of stuff, and one of the things he'd asked people to bring spoons from home that he could bend, and he walked around the auditorium, collected them in a cardboard box, and then emptied them out on the stage, and he said that the audience should select anyone they wanted, and they selected a rather large tablespoon, and he picked that up and went, "Oh, like, I can't do that one, can I?" And I was like, "Well, why not?" You know, but he didn't. No, he did do a bit of spoon bending and a bit of this and that, but he didn't perform. He didn't make the seed grow. But there's a thing when you do mentalism, if you're too on the nose, it's less convincing. If you're, we say, off by one, or you get the date a little bit off, or it seems somehow more amazing, because if you were doing it by a trick method, you'd get it perfect. But I think when it comes to a phoenix... hearing it's not quite the same. So no, I think in magic there are some times when an apparent mistake is an advantage. Quite,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. Mentalism is such a good example of that, because you know it's just all about presentation with mentalism. Yes, okay. Of course, there's methods. So it's all about you and how you present it, and that's the one thing that's hugely different between, say, myself doing magic as the performer. I'm fully in control of what I'm doing and what I'm saying. And if I make a deliberate mistake or a mistake happens, I can fix it.
Let's go back to our history of magic. One of the game changers in the 20th century must have been when magicians started working on television.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it changes everything because it now went out into a wider audience. You know, you now weren't confined to this one space where people had to buy a ticket, or you were a hired form of entertainment. You know, now it was accessible if you had a television. And I believe there was something like 4.7 million televisions in the 1950s. But that's still, bear in mind, there's very few channels, an extraordinary amount of people that will watch something. And if it's magic, what a great way of getting it popularised again. And David Berglas was the first magician on television.
The International Man of Mystery.
Before then, he was the International Man of Radio.
He did magic on the radio, didn't he?
He did magic on the radio.
How did that go? A bit like I did earlier.
Nobody could see how it was done.
He was this extraordinary man who just had this really wonderful way about executing brilliant magic, but in a real showbiz way. You know, he was very much all about the big stunts and creating a real buzz. One thing he did on television, which is just bonkers, but I love it. He had this whole DIY kit. You know this one? There's a box hanging and bits of wood are inside, and an audience member would choose what bit of furniture that they want built. And then suddenly the box, you'd hear all these sounds and bits of wood flying out of the box. And suddenly a dressing table, I think it was a dressing table, appeared. And so that was a bit odd. And then he went back in. I think they chose something else. And then again, you hear all the noise and the kerfuffle, and it's a wooden rocking horse. The wooden rocking horse comes out. And at the end of the episode, the rocking horse comes to life. And he didn't do that on television. And if you can imagine what an extraordinary opportunity to play around with lights and cameras and the ability to do this, because, you know, this was all, I guess, pre-recorded. And so they were able to do a few things. And maybe make things look a little bit more wild than you might be able to have done on stage. So I think that was a huge game changer. And he had several television series, not only in the UK, but also in Europe as well, in Holland. And not just him, you know, after that followed very significant magicians such as David Nixon, of course, and Paul Daniels. So we have had such wonderful magic on our televisions here in the UK. And in America, it's just different kind of magic.
One of the things about Paul Daniels is that he had a female assistant, Debbie McGee. Does that go back a long way, this idea of a magician having an assistant?
Well, yes. I mean, P.T. Selbert was quite famously the one who invented the soaring and half illusion, which caused a huge stir. And I wouldn't say that that was one of the first assistants, but it certainly popularised this idea of a woman being kind of scantily clad, getting into a box and having something done magically. And often these were the wives or the girlfriends of the magicians. They were quite petite. Maybe they were dancers. A lot of them were in that sort of entertainment world anyway. But it's got quite a long history.
Yeah, I mean, I think that 1921 was the Sawing Through a Woman, P.T. Selbert presented. And, you know, I think as with a lot of things in magic, I think things happen slightly by accident rather than by design, because I think some magic theorists have said that sawing a woman in half caught on because people were so angry about women getting the vote. Because
1918,
they got the vote. And indeed, P.T. Selbert, who was actually, his real name was Tibbles, but he reversed it, and that was Selbert. And he's credited as the first to saw through a woman. And he did apparently invite Christabel Pankhurst to be sawn in half. I think she declined. She had something better going on that day. But so some of them did, I think, afterwards catch on to that idea of making it slightly political, but I think it happened by accident, the first stage of it. And I think it came about through you need talented, lithe and smart people to do some of these things. And very often that was the partner of the magician. And I'm not saying that, generally speaking, that women are more talented and lithe and smarter than men, but probably a lot of cases they are. So actually it's easier to point at a box. You know, there's a joke, isn't there, about, you know, the fact that a lot of the time the assistant is doing, you know, really most of the work while the magician just points. And
no, that is what happens.
Yeah. you know, it's so I think there is an element of the also the glamour of that era, that the variety shows. And then you have a whole era of kind of slightly saucy cabaret and in the sort of coming into the 40s and 50s. And I think that's probably where the sort of cliched, you know, sort of tits and teeth kind of like magician's assistant sort of came from. But before then, you know, it wasn't a thing. And this is a slight sidebar. There's a wonderful quote about that just reminded me, because, of course, during the scope of what we talked about, I've gone from this magic almost being burnt at the stake to now we're talking about, you know, assistants and sort of being shoved in boxes. And there was a great magic philosopher called Max Maven, who passed away last year, and he said that magicians of the 20th and 21st century took an art that was inherently profound and rendered it trivial.
That's beautiful, isn't it? That is wonderful. Yeah. I can understand that, because like you were saying earlier, that there has always been a sense of awe about magic from the earliest times. And now, in a way, that's kind of been replaced by buzz, which isn't quite as profound.
But that's also, I mean, as we've been speaking today, you know, we've mentioned many females in magic. So when these sort of box jumpers, as some of them are called, sort of when that became popularized, people always ask, why aren't there more women in magic? Well, they've always been around, actually. They really have. And they've been doing extraordinarily well and topping the bills all over the world. It's just, I guess, they were sort of written out of history. So this idea that, because people often ask, when did it go from a woman being an assistant and then becoming a magician? Well, it's actually, I think, quite the opposite. It was, when did women sort of top the bills as magicians and artists and solo performers, and then suddenly were more looked at as women who as women who were in boxes? And definitely that was around the 40s
box
and
jumpers.
50s.
I love that.
It's quite a term that people use.
Debbie McGee, who's like the most fantastic talented performer, started off as a ballet dancer. Mm. And Annette Poole was a fundamental part of that show and actually had a speaking role in that show. Yes, it was. She did become known as the lovely Domi McGee, but she very much was, in many respects, an equal partner. That's why people know her now. And if you look over to sort of David Copperfield, he worked with this amazing lady called Joni Spener, who was originally his choreographer, but he brought in this very romantic style of magic. So rather than the assistant coming on and being sort of just there to carry a prop, that the whole illusion would be presented as a kind of a love story. And he described that, and I got to work with Joni. She was my associate on Ghost when I worked in New York. And she talked about it for many hours. And they actually said that it was a really risky thing. Like, no one had actually presented that style of the magician and the girl, it being a kind of a romantic and almost like a dance. They say that Joni Spener was the one that got David Copperfield to dance. And that was really the time that he became an international, you know, the big time when he was dating Claudia Schiffer and came and toured to the Europe. So he took his magic, which he always makes storytelling, but also made it romantic. Mm. And I think that was a breakthrough. So it wasn't just the glamorous assistant, it was telling a story of a romance. And I think that was another style. So within this kind of, in a way, cliche of the magician's assistant, there were lots of performing duos of Kaylin and Ginger. They were very much these duo that were very even. And before she got sawn in half, she gave him a right, you know, mouthful. She'd be talking and saying, "Don't put that there," and she'd almost be in control of it. Mm. And of course, the amazing female performers, which we keep discovering, that were never properly written about.
Yeah, and that's what television had done, and it has, and it continues to do through magic, is showcase innovative ideas, change the way we look at assistants through watching David Copperfield and the way in which he incorporates that. And that's, I think, the power of television and magic.
Was Tommy Cooper a good magician?
Ah, fantastic.
See, I don't think he was.
I think he was.
No, I think he was fantastic, but everyone says that. And I've never seen any evidence. Sorry.
Yeah, but that's because...
No,
because he deliberately made it terrible.
Yeah. You know, but when he did try and do it, it never worked out.
It's this other thing of the magician as a personality, isn't it?
It's not about
comic, like a clown, really, at the independent stage.
It's not about the magic, it's about you. That's always been my favourite thing to you know, my favourite saying, because it's all about you. And with Tommy, it was all about him, absolutely.
I think it is, and I think that's true, but sometimes I think you have to have the both things. And I think back in the day, I mean, the reason that, say, Houdini broke through was because what he did was absolutely unbelievable. And people would talk on the street about him. Houdini was like late 1800s through to when he died in 1926. And he was, you know, became known as the world's greatest escape artist. No bond would hold Harry Houdini. So he would create or concoct any kind of number of extraordinary scenarios in which he would escape from Russian prison vans or have handcuffs that were designed by world handcuff experts. And he would escape from them. The very famous thing called the Mirror Cuffs, which the Daily Mirror challenged him. And was that at the Hippodrome he did that? I can't remember.
I think it was.
It was
actually,
at the Hippodrome. Laura knows a lot about the Hippodrome. And these extraordinary stories of him sort of being behind a screen for, you know, an hour and a half while the audience were going absolutely insane, and him coming out still in the cuffs, you know, and then going back behind the screen and eventually coming out sweating and having escaped after 3 hours, and the audience being so thrilled and excited that they'd carry him home on their shoulders back to the hotel. I mean, this is something you cannot imagine today. And I think a lot of it was to do with, I think, his methods. He would literally do anything at all to create that effect, whether it was a lockpick hidden in a place the sun rarely shined, or whether it was bribing a doorman or the jailman. He was all about effect. All about effect. And I think that actually back in the day, it was about what you did. I think it was Selbit and the sawing in half. And now it's become less so, but I don't think magicians do wrong by having sensational individual things that are associated with them.
When I say it's not about the magic, it's about you. What I mean is, if you are an illusionist, well, you should have fantastic illusions. Or if you're a slide, you should be good at what you do. But now if you're not very interesting to watch, or you don't have great presentational I don't want to say personality, yeah. But, you know, basically, if you're a bit dull, it can be quite dull to watch, even if you're extraordinary at whatever. So the magic should be good. But I think the performance is, for me, still more important.
But you see, you have all of that. But I say this to magicians sometimes, and they don't like it, because they go this, you hear this thing, which I think is a bit of an excuse. They go, oh, it's all about the personality. So, oh, the audience has just got to like you. I'm like, well, they've got to like you, but you've also got to do something interesting. And also, I disagree. Yeah. I don't think people do have to like you. I think you just have to be interesting.
That's
so
true.
For example,
Jerry Sadowitz,
Penn and Teller. I mean, would you really want Penn and Teller around for dinner? You know, they're fantastic and they're friends, but they are deliberately odd, you know, and a bit peculiar. And some of these characters in history.
I mean, Jerry Sadowitz is quite famously not likable.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you want to see him because you know he's extraordinary and you know his skill set is great. So maybe not likable, but certainly interesting.
Yeah, interesting.
I
agree.
Absolutely agree with
and,
that.
But you have every, you know, you've got
Thank
it
you.
All.
You're the best.
I always have to ask one final question. Paul, what's your cunning plan for the future of magic?
I do think that magic and theatre are a great combination, because I sometimes say, I have been known to say, that people don't always love magicians, but they do love magic, in the sense of, if you put magic into a story, which of course it's a big part of in many, many things, then they always love it. So I think that it doesn't mean to say that magicians should go out and like become actors and do that sort of thing. But I think always remember the outside stuff of magic. Like, always remember there's always more than magic, and storytelling and engaging people theatrically, I think it's a very important thing. And I think that's where probably it has its strength, and it always will do, because you can't do always bigger and bigger things. I mean, David Copperfield apparently is about to vanish the moon. Seriously. I mean, some cynics have said the moon vanishes itself very well every 28 days. But David is vanishing the moon. And I love that he's still doing that.
Yes.
And that is his thing. But what are you going to do next? You know what I mean? So I think it's about personality. I think that it might be about engaging with other art forms. It tends to be very secretive and therefore slightly cut off. And I would encourage magicians to embrace other art forms and make it theatrical, embrace other things that are going on. Because as technology advances, we have to find other ways to make our magic magical.
Laura, what's going to happen to magic? What's going to happen to you?
Oh, please do say the cunning plan, though.
So I don't know.
Can't
Laura,
imagine.
What's your cunning plan for magic?
You've literally made my year. I think magic in general is in a really good place. Like Paul said, for me as well, I completely agree. I love storytelling magic. It's the kind of magic I love to watch. And in New York, actually, we were just there recently. There are 7 shows, magic shows, and they're more of a parlor setting. So, yes, you've got the big grand shows and you've got illusions and such in theater. But what's really popular now is exactly the kind of magic I like to watch. And it's certainly getting a bit bigger in New York, and I'm starting to see a few pop up here. And that is a magician telling a story, whether it be a historical story or a made-up story or their own story, using magic to do that in a smaller setting with intimate audiences of 50 to 200-300 people is something that's becoming very popular now. And I think that's a great thing for magic, because people can really now start to go and experience skill and personality in a way that I think magic should be seen. It's my favourite kind of magic to watch. So for it to be popularised again is just fantastic. And for me personally, I'm writing a new show, and Cheat will always continue. I'll always perform it. And in the meantime, I'll do private parties and corporate events to fund my passion for getting into a theatre.
Laura London, Paul Keeve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hell, where are they gone? Where are they? Wow. Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. I'm Tony Robinson. This is my Cunning Cast, produced by Melissa Fitzgerald, and it's a Zinc Media production.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.